Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's July 14th, 2017 program, the Oregon 2017 Legislative Wrap-Up. This is the 38th program in our current programming year. My name is Josh Burstein, and I am a City Club board member. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member today at cityclubofeugene.org. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including the Oregon Country Fair. The Oregon Country Fair creates experiences that nourish the spirit, explore living artfully and authentically on Earth, and transform culture in magical, joyous, and healthy ways. Today, we have a very dynamic program for you. We will be hearing from a member of the Oregon Senate and a member of the Oregon House of Representatives. They will share their impressions and experience with some of the successes and letdowns from the 2017 session of the Oregon State Legislature. The legislature convened on February 1st and adjourned last Friday, July 7th. They will tell us what was accomplished and what was left on the table after meeting almost daily for the past 6 months in the state capitol in Salem. We are fortunate to have them here today to give us their insights into how the Oregon legislature addressed a nearly $2 billion deficit and in the end came up with a balanced budget. This session, our local Lane County legislators were key players in everything from Ways and Means Budget Writing Committee to transportation planning and infrastructure, revenue restructuring, and other issues important not only here in the Willamette Valley, but throughout the state, such as housing regulations, education funding, environmental and healthcare regulation. The coordinators of today's program are Marty Wilde and John Belcher. And now I would like to introduce Joel Corin, City Club President-elect, who is going to introduce today's speakers.
Thank you for your warm applause. As Josh was giving the introduction and thanking our sponsors, he thanked the Oregon Country Fair. And as a relative newcomer to Oregon, I just realized the wisdom of the Oregon Constitution forcing the legislature to stop at about the time of the Oregon Country Fair. I'm not sure what that means, but it's very Oregon, very Oregon. But, and I do want you to know that we are ahead of some of the other groups in Lane County that are having a legislative wrap-up. The Register Guard subscriber event on Monday night, when this show will be broadcast. If you can't get there live, Julie Fahey, Cedric Hayden, and Floyd Przanski will all be giving this talk again. So you folks are lucky. You're going to hear it first. You'll have the weekend to contemplate it before Monday night. The highlights and the lowlights of the legislative session will be discussed by two of our area legislators, and the first question will be asked by another. Senator Floyd Przanski was first elected to the Oregon Legislature in 1994. He served in the House of Representatives between 1995 and 2000. In 2003, Floyd was appointed to represent Oregon Senate District 4 in 2003. He was elected in 2004 to complete the current term and has been reelected three times since 2006. Floyd is an avid cyclist, home brewer, he didn't bring any. He lives in Eugene with his wife. During the interim, Floyd works as a municipal prosecutor and serves on various legislative committees, work groups, and commissions. He's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, co-vice chair of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulation, didn't bring any of that either, and serves on the Senate Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and the Senate Committee on General Government and Accountability. Cedric Hayden is serving his second session as District 7's state representative. Now completing his second session in the state as a state representative, he grew up in rural Fall Creek, Oregon, as a member of what is now a sixth generation covered wagon pioneer family. When not occupied in the legislature, Cedric is a businessman operating several businesses, including a charter air service based in Cresswell, a horse and cattle ranch in Fall Creek, and a heavy equipment business specializing in combating wildland fires. We're actually very lucky he's here today. And has a hospital-based dental practice treating special needs dental patients. Cedric serves as vice chair of the House Committee for Healthcare and is also a member of the House Early Childhood and Family Supports and Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Our first questioner today is also a legislator. Julie Fahey is a first-term member of the Oregon House for District 14. She has 15 years of experience in the private sector as a business consultant and co-founder of a human resources consulting firm for businesses and nonprofits. Through her work, she helps employers pay their employees fairly, build skilled workforces, and create the kind of environment and culture that makes an organization a great place to work. She serves on the Joint Committee on Marijuana Regulation, Vice Chair of the Commission on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, and the Commission on Transparency. Senator Przanski, I think you're first.
All right, thank you everyone. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today for the Eugene City Club. It's my honor and pleasure to be here to give you kind of my perspective of how I think things went during this last session. What I'm going to do is kind of just go through what I would consider some of our high points and also point out some of the areas I thought that we did not complete the work that we needed to do that will be needing to be looked at and addressed in the future. First of all, I will say that the session itself went pretty smooth in the sense that there was not a lot of animosity on the Senate side. I will reserve my comments more for the Senate as compared to the House and let Cedric give his perspective on the House since I was not there on a day-to-day basis. From our perspective, every once in a while you looked over and you could see that we needed to maybe give a little assurance that things were going to go fine and we didn't all have to have meltdowns toward the end. It seemed like there were some issues on the House side as to moving forward and closing out. But we did, in fact, pass a transportation package, a $5.3 billion package that will, in fact, impact across the state. What I will tell you is that in the dealings that we had for the package and what is going to be realized in Senate District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties, is some expansion on highway passing on Highway 58 west of Oak Ridge. There's going to be some additional work that's going to be more than just the two counties, but the Southern Oregon seismic work will continue to be working. One area that I've worked on over the last 11 years, which I'm very pleased to see is coming together now, is money that's going to be going into the territorial highway. What is anticipated based on the bill that passed, the territorial currently the territorial highway is a state highway. It will be transferred to Lane County, so it will be a cross-jurisdictional change. There will be $30 million that will be coming from the state, with my understanding that the state will stay on the hook, as it may be, for upgrades on some of the bridge structures that are on territorial highway. But it will, in fact, become part of the county roadway system. In exchange for that, the county will be giving up what is known as the Delta Highway Exchange and the Delta Highway. So familiar, we're up Delta Oaks, where the shopping center is. The interchange itself currently is county. So the full stretch of Delta Highway, going back to the 126 bypass, also known as 105, will all be transferred to the state, including that interchange, and that will allow for additional focus at the state level for upgrading the interchange there at the Beltline. The other portion of this that is worth noting is an area that's on the south end of Territorial Highway, usually referred to as the Gillespie Corners, which is where the Lorraine Highway intersects at on Territorial Highway going south to the community of Lorraine. Of the $30 million that's been allocated, my understanding, 20 of them, that 30 is going to be used for road upgrades. If you remember in 1996, we had a fatality that was on that road that involved a bicyclist, a friend of mine, and a truck. And this is an area that many of the wineries in that area have wanted to have upgraded for better travel, for tourism, et such. And this is going to be a welcome area to enhance the safety and also, I think, the tourist and a reach to that area. In the Medicaid area, we had what's known as the provider tax. This is something that you'll probably get more information on as the day goes, as time goes forward. The provider tax is a means for us to actually be able to ensure that 350,000 Oregonians are going to maintain health care. This is an area that Cedric worked near and dear to, so I'll reserve more comments for him as to the details. The educational funding is an area that I'm really concerned with as to what we didn't do, but at the same time, we have to acknowledge what we did do. For the K-12 education budget, we have an $8.2 billion. That is an 11% increase over the last biennium. But you have to look beyond the numbers as to what is actually the impact. With $8.2 billion, I will have school districts in my Senate district that will need to be making changes as to either staffing levels or days and number of school days because they will not be able to make ends meet based on what their portion of the $8.2 billion will be. We had the opportunity, and this is one of the areas I thought we fell short on, raising new revenue that could have been dedicated to education and would have been dedicated to education, and that's how the bill was going to be structured. But because of needing to have a supermajority on the Senate side 18, on the House side 36, we were not able to accommodate the number of votes to actually get anything passed. And I will tell you that there was a lot of wheeling and dealing, a lot of opportunities given to individual members who were voting no on it to see whether or not they would give a vote for the revenue in exchange for maybe additional work within their own districts, and that did not happen. This is an area that we need to continue to be looking at and really focusing on how we're going to get stability within our system and ensure that we're not kicking the can down the road every 2 years and trying to come back. My perspective on this is that since the passage of Measure 5 back in 1990, where we had the shift of funding schools, K-12, going from the local to the state, that the state has never obligated itself to the levels that were we had seen at the local revenue-based individuals that were providing the money at the local level. And because of that, I feel that we as a state have continued to shortchange our students, our kids, as to their opportunities to be able to actually operate and pass the necessities to be employable within the state. And in many cases, we see many individuals being recruited from out of state for jobs that should and could be held by Oregonians if they had the opportunity to compete on that level. In the areas that I work, I will tell you that I was very pleased that on the judiciary side, we were able to get the grand jury recording bill passed. This is going to ensure more integrity into our criminal justice system by recording grand jury proceedings. We will, in fact, ensure that a person who gives testimony in a secret proceeding is whatever story they testify to in the grand jury is not going to change at the trial court jury. Will in fact allow for those individuals who change their stories to be held accountable, where in the past that was not literally possible because we've been working under a system for 150 plus years that only required for a designated grand juror to take handwritten notes as to the testimony they heard. Clearly they would never be able to document verbatim what an individual witness says, and then in many cases because of it just being some type of note-taking, there was no way to decipher what was being said and what was actually recorded, or to even have the juror who took the notes to be able to recall after some period of time. So that is one of the areas I thought was very important for us to do. I will say in the judiciary area, there are a couple areas that I thought that we fell. One was advanced directives. This is an opportunity where individuals can give directions as to how they want their life to, let's say, continue or not have a certain medical procedures done. What we're attempting to do, and this is now the third session that we've tried, to unify the forms and ensure that we have legitimate forms that can in fact be used, that do in fact honor the wishes of the individual who is wanting to use an advance directive. Unfortunately, even though we passed the bill on the Senate side, It got caught up in the last-minute deals, and one of the deals was to get a vote on the provider tax. The House killed the advanced directive bill to get a Republican who is retiring from the legislature to actually vote for maintaining the provider tax that we did get. So these are kind of the areas of where what we refer to as sausage making. My frustration is many times they don't use my recipe that I think they should use in making the sausage. So with that said, the other area that I think that we're going to see a significant issue in the future, because we did not address it, and that is torque caps. We had a case that came through the Oregon courts last year in May, so in 2016, that basically turned our system upside down. I was hoping and expecting that we would actually be able to have a reasonable tort limit that was above and beyond the $500,000 mark that it is now. And so now at this point we don't, and so you're going to see in two cases I can tell you that where the juries have awarded verdicts and awards to individuals that were seriously injured at different times, close to $10 million, that those judgments are going to be cut down to $500,000. What does that mean for you or me? As taxpayers, we will be paying for their long-term assistance because we were not able to, let's say, reopen what the tort cap should be as compared to what it has was set back in statute over 20 years ago, but we had been working under the theory and the belief from the courts that there was unlimited tort claims that could be filed with no cap, and at this point we did not adjust that. So you're going to see individual victims of not only personal injury but sex abuse type cases that are going to actually be limited as to being able to have a jury award what is due to them based on the wrongs that were done to them. Other areas of concern, one that Cedric and I worked on is House Bill 2590. This was to ensure additional money into the Roseburg area after the UCC shooting that occurred. We saw that states step in and do a lot of work. They have, in fact, increased money for the community college's public safety sector, but we were hoping to get additional money into the Roseburg to help the community to still transition through the horror that that occurred at UCC. Unfortunately, based on my review, it looks like that did not make the final packet. I've talked to the co-chair of Ways and Means on the Senate side, and he told me that he wasn't sure, and we just have not found it. So if it got placed in there, I'm glad that it did, but I believe it didn't. And so this is another area where I think the state dropped the ball in helping a local community that needed its assistance to ensure the transition from a very horrible mass shooting to actually be able to get back on the feet and do what the work they need to do. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and stop and allow for Cedric to make his openings.
Thank you. My name is Cedric Hayden. I'm a state representative for House District 7. Pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I got elected in 2014. 2015 was my first legislative session, so I don't have the history in the building. But one of the things that was is a side note to us, to me, my father, Cedric Lee Hayden, some of you may remember, has been my chief of staff up there for the last year. He's in his mid-80s, and he's going to be retiring officially on his birthday, which is August 4th of this year. And so I had the opportunity to give him privileges of the House and of the floor. And for me, that was a special time. It was nice that Speaker Kotek worked with us on that and brought him down to the floor, and he was able to come have lunch. What you see on TV is not really what always happens in the legislature. We have our disagreements on the House or the Senate floor, and then we all go up to the lunchroom, and we all have lunch together, and that's reserved just for the members, so the lobbyists and influential groups are not in there. So my father actually had to get permission to be able to share that time with me. So that was just a side note, nice thing. I'm going to run through a couple of things that I was very pleased with this legislative session, some bills that I was a chief sponsor of to get a feel for. House Bill 2591 got signed into law June 18th, and that's a Williams Syndrome Association Awareness Month. Williams Syndrome is a condition that special needs kids have. It can be life-threatening, and in many cases it is life-threatening because of their cardiovascular problems with that current condition. And so the more awareness that we can push out for the groups to be able to advocate for fundraising, and through the Oregon Medical Association, through some of their education material, we get that information out to the physicians, to the pediatricians, so more of those checks are being done at birth, and so we have more opportunity to save those children's lives. And so that passed unanimously. That was one that I shepherded through. A really big bill, I think, an anti-poverty bill that I've worked on for three sessions this time around was House Bill 3405. And what that will do, I hope, it does take federal communication and federal approval. What it does is it takes a child care tax credit when working parents go out and they have a job and they work and they have children that they have to pay for child care. They also have a tax burden that they have to pay. April 15 at the end of the cycle, the tax cycle, they can apply for a tax credit and they can get a lot of that money back if they're in a certain poverty level that they can, and it goes up quite a bit to incomes of families up to $80,000 if they have enough children actually qualify for this tax credit. But in the lower incomes, it's a big struggle for them to be able to pay their child care bill monthly and pay their taxes and be able to have quality child care. And so just from a business cash flow common sense approach for the last three sessions, I have tried to convince my colleagues up there, and I have convinced them, but they're worried about the federal government side of it because there's some regulation that says if you give a tax credit back monthly, it can be countable. What that means is it doesn't really count against their income, but it counts against their other services like their SNAP programs. Now, we also have a legislative opinion that says there's an exemption that we wouldn't have to do that, so we wrangled that for the 2015-2016 session. For the 2017 session, we both came to the middle a little bit, and we said, okay, we will let the federal government, the USDA, decide this. And so the Department of Human Services has already sent, the governor has signed that bill, they've given me a copy of it, and they've already sent a request for a waiver so that Oregonians can get this child care credit back monthly, which doesn't cost the state anymore because they can load it directly on their SNAP benefit. So they have a system that they can get these dollars to these people in the low-income categories that we're targeting so that they can afford their daycare. And the problem with getting it back at the end of the year or when they file their taxes is many of them do a rapid refund. That fee costs them a whole month. That's about a 12 to a 15% fee. Costs them a whole month of daycare. And so, that would go to your H&R Blocks and whatnot. And a lot of these funds are refundable tax credits, so they actually come from the state. We're really pushing. We think that's exciting. We think that's a good anti-poverty measure bill that we got through. One that I worked directly with Senator Perzanski on, and he was very helpful on, was House Bill 3030. This was brought to me by Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Committee that works with the Cottage Grove City Council and with their high schools down there. And it was on nitrous oxide. I'm a dentist by trade, so I have a background in nitrous. That is a medical inhalant, if you will. If you go to the dentist, it's laughing gas. If you go to the operating room, it's what we use to help prep people to go to sleep. And we keep a mixture on that for them to be relaxed. It's highly regulated under the medical community, but strangely enough, recreational nitrous oxide is not regulated. And so in theory, a 12-year-old could go down and buy something called a Whip-It. Now, that's not whipped cream. We took some beating in Facebook over, Dr. Hayden regulating whipped cream. It's not what we were doing. What we were regulating was the ability for somebody under 18 years old to go buy a nitrous oxide canister, take something called a cracker, it's a little metal thing, and then they put a balloon on and then blow that up. The problem with that is that's 100% nitrous oxide, and children, for the pediatric side of dentistry where we use it, children require 75% oxygen. And in this delivery system that they kind of make up, it's 100% nitrous oxide. There's no oxygen for their brains. And so if they're on a couple of multiple balloons there, it actually causes brain damage. So very excited about kind of that small bill to get done for them. Another bill that I worked on, I do a lot with special needs. My practice is limited to special needs in the hospital. We had a compulsory school age that moved in 2015 by one vote on the House floor from 7 to 6. And while that's okay, I understand the need for that, the children that we have in special needs categories are often 24 to 36 months in development behind. And so it put them at odds with their peer groups as far as going in and filling out the K tests that they do. They pick colors and numbers and circles and stuff like that. And disabled children are smaller in size typically. They don't fit in with that peer group. And so it was squeezing down a 36-month range that we really had pretty well between 7 and 5 down to 6 and 5. And if you're born right after the deadline, it really squeezes you down to 12 months. That was looking up to be a controversial bill, and some of our friends in the Senate, Senator Przanski included, allowed me to talk with them about the need for parents of special needs children to have a little more flexibility, and it ended up passing unanimously, I believe, and the governor signed it. It is limited to the parent's choice, and it's limited for people with a cognitive or physical disability, but that was something that I just work with almost on a daily basis, and I see that. And so, you know, as a citizen legislature, that gives us the opportunity to bring where something might be kind of not thought about, you know, where compulsory school age dropping to 6, yeah, for 95% of the kids, that probably makes sense. But that doesn't mean we leave behind the 5 or 10%. So I was pleased with that. Another thing that we were able to get through, House Bill 2216, and this was the right for foster children and their siblings. So as we know, there's a lot of struggles in the foster health care system or the foster care system. We're really working hard at Salem to solve that. I can't say that we've solved it completely, but it is one of the biggest issues. It's a heartfelt issue. We've got to do better for our foster kids. And separating those children from their siblings just isn't the right thing to do. So we were able to get them a Bill of Rights to help them. Another one, talking about Congress, we do engage, like with the child care credits, we engaged with Measure 4, urging Congress for the Raise the Family Care Act. For a lot of our seniors that rely on the family members to help take care of them, this is kind of a federally funded thing, so we can't do a lot at the state to do that, but we did bring attention to that. It's an important issue, and we want to keep moving forward with getting better resources for families to take care of their aging family members, which we all will be at some point. In my private life, in my nonprofit life, I frequently go over to the Federated States of Micronesia and the charity that we work with there that my wife and I founded built the first dental clinic there for 60,000 people. And those folks are called the COFA population, or the Compact Free Association Treaty. In 1996, the federal government disenfranchised them from any health care insurance that we have through the federal government. So we've worked over the last couple of sessions to restore some of that. That's something I've been supportive of. We were able to get in some physical health and some oral health for them, and we were able to continue that this session. So that was, you know, in 2015, that was actually a small expansion. We set aside some money for it. They didn't utilize all the money, so we were able to keep that going. As far as nonprofits, we run places in Madagascar and Zambia, Micronesia, and then, of course, here in Oregon, all over the state. Total House health care bills, there was 172 House health care bills. There was 2,647, I don't have that in my notes, I think that's off the top of my head, bills introduced, so we had a lot of work. That wasn't all health care that was included in that. One of the things that we did in 2015, which I supported across the aisle, was the Toxic Free Kids bill. I think that's an important thing for us to have. We don't always follow in line with our caucuses or our party, and a father of three young children, and a special needs child, so that's where a lot of the passion comes from, protecting this class. That was important to me to get through, and we got that through in 2015, and then we had some corrections and some fee things, so we had to work on it again. So it was a little bit of a battle, but we were able to get that through. Okay, so bigger issue items. Transportation, healthcare, revenue were items that got through. I agree on the CCO bill. Revenue didn't get through, but those were big ticket items. CCO bill didn't get a budget note that I can find anywhere. I was really disappointed. We both worked very hard on that. Wanted to increase the federal poverty level from 138% for veterans. If they claim a disability, they can get up to coverage up to 250%. I don't feel like veterans should have to necessarily claim that disability to go from 138 to 250. So we tried to get a small package for oral health care for them. I wasn't able to get that across the line. And just to close up, we did get a transportation bill. Senator Prezansky went over that pretty thoroughly. We did get a health care bill. I will admit that there's some health care taxes. I come from the standpoint of air, water, food, low-income housing, and health care shouldn't be taxed. And so I am a petitioner on a referendum to surgically extract some of the taxes in that health care package, but to leave the framework of the whole package. I'm a strong supporter of Medicaid. And the revenue just didn't get across the line because there wasn't equivalent cost containment that was offered. So that was kind of the boil down to of the one thing that didn't get across that both sides wanted. But the one side of the aisle said it's got to be balanced with cost containment. So that's kind of a wrap up of what we did.
Hi, everyone. I'm Representative Julie Fahey and today's first questioner. One of the legislature's biggest responsibilities is to balance our budget. And we started with a $1.4 billion budget shortfall this year, which means that by continuing our current programs into the next biennium, the cost of that would be $1.4 billion more than the projected revenue that came in May. In order to fill that budget gap this year, we passed the healthcare provider tax to help people on Medicaid. We made some targeted spending cuts in government agencies, and we passed a bill that took a little action in terms of reining in the long-term cost of government. But we weren't able to make meaningful investments in our education system, and our long-term budget outlook is not particularly good. We're likely to be back here again in 2 years, facing a similarly large budget shortfall. Oregon has some of the lowest corporate tax levels in the entire country. We have an over-reliance on the personal income tax, and we face a growing unfunded liability in PERS. All of those things contribute to our long-term budget instability. Personally, my greatest disappointment this session was our failure to reach a compromise on overhauling our corporate tax structure and on taking further action to stabilize the long-term cost of government. So my question is, do you think we need to reform our corporate tax structure, and specifically how? And do you think we need to take action on the long-term cost side of the ledger, and specifically how?
I guess I got the short straw on the first part of the question there. So, yes, I do believe we need to have new revenue coming in. I do believe that we need to be looking at how we are currently taxing corporations as compared to what historically we've done. As most of you know, we have an income tax system, one personal as well as corporate. The gurus in this area across the country are saying the historical way of taxing corporations through an income tax is not the appropriate way to be moving forward because of changes in just how money moves and how commerce is done. I would have and do still would like to see some type of a, let's call it Measure 97 Light, if you remember, where we're going to have some type of a gross receipts type of a tax structure based on for corporations. I do believe that there's a way, and I do believe that we actually had that in the bill that we were trying to move forward that took in a lot of the concerns that was what I found what was wrong with 97. When Measure 97 was before the voters last November, I had two questions that seemed to be asked to me on a pretty regular basis. First of all, the inflexibility of having one taxing level rate for all businesses. And all you have to do is look to the state to the north of us, Washington, who does have this style of taxing. They have, I believe, 23 different levels of rates of taxation depending on the individual businesses, what their margins are, and they have taken and accommodated for that type of approach. So I think something that would give a more than one level of taxation rate would be appropriate. And the other was how the tax was going to be compounded. And what I mean by that, every time there's a transaction with the property from business to business to business, each time it was being taxed. And many individuals I work with and communicate with thought that that was just unfair. And I agree that it seems to me that you need to figure out what that point of where that tax is going to be, apply it, but not to have it every time it moves from one person's hand or one corporation's hand to the next, have a new separate tax applied at that time. Regarding cost containment, the second part of the question, clearly we started down that road, and I will tell you this is not to be partisan, but I'm not sure how I say it any differently. But on the Senate side, there was a lot of discussion, and there was a no vote from everyone, the 13 members of the Republican caucus on the Senate side that voted against the cost containment that we put forward. The reasons that I heard was that they didn't think it went far enough. I guess the question I would pose back to them, why wouldn't you take something versus nothing and continue to work? Many, many times we have found through our process, you can't get everything you want. As I said, I wish sometimes when they're making sausage at the end, they'd follow my recipe, but they don't. Does that mean I'm not going to take anything else that comes out my way? Absolutely not. In fact, many of the things that I stood here and supported and praise is stuff that I wanted to see go further than it did, but I'm not going to cut it off short. So I think that we took the right step by moving forward on the cost containment. Some of the other areas that they want us to be looking at are ones that I think are direct conflict with what the courts have decided when it comes to PERS issues. Well, I've been down that road. This isn't my first rodeo when it comes to trying to do PERS reform. And what I've always said is if it's something that we think we can legitimately do, something that seems to be fair and balanced, let's go for it. But let's not continue to run the same flag up the flagpole that the courts have already told us we can't do.
So, yeah, the cost containment versus revenue was a big discussion. I sit on Early Childhood and Family Services Committee, and we had a lot of talk about, you know, how do we get the revenue to do what we feel is appropriate for, particularly for families and children. And one of those discussions, it was about our tax structure. I've looked at that quite a bit, and I agree with most of what was said here, that Oregon has too much of their tax revenue that comes into the state basically through people working, through their income, through their paycheck, and has a lower, which is one of the highest in the nation, and has a lower corporate tax structure in some cases, not in all cases. The problem is with trying to find that balance is saying, okay, we're willing to bring down the individual tax rate, bring up the corporate tax rate, and come up with X amount of money that we want to provide in revenue. And then the flip side of that is we want to see something equivalent in cost containment. Because I think if you take an honest look at where we're heading with our current service level, there is no way, regardless of what revenue package you put together, that you can keep businesses here. I mean, we just saw Roseburg Lumber Company announced that they're going to build a $200 million plant in North Carolina. That's tough to take, right? That's tough to see. 150 jobs leaving Springfield that could have been here. And so we have to find a balance in that so these organizations, these businesses look at that and say, Oregon's a healthy place to do business. The PERS is a difficult battle. It's one that I think there is some minor tweaking into it through the legislature, part of that, I suppose, but I'm not one of the tier one type people in the PERS system. But those people were given a promise, and I've always supported that. The people that have done their duty to the state and had their agreement, that needs to stay in place. So there is no point, I agree, there is no point trying to rehash what the courts have told us. But if you look at healthcare 1067, one of three buckets, and my work in healthcare actually ended up in a work group in education to try and find cost containment. It ended up me being invited to the Brighter Oregon Solution for balancing cost containment. And they brought me in to talk about healthcare. There's three buckets in healthcare that we have with the public employees, and one of those is in 1067, meaning that if one person works for state government in one agency and another person works for state agency in another area, say ODOT and Department of Fish and Wildlife, or a legislator, or in something else. Both of those agencies offer full family coverage for them. And when you get into medical coverage, there's not a huge advantage to have, you know, basically two insurance, a family package here paid for by the state, and a family package over in this department is paid for by the state. And so one of the ideas that I didn't do exclusively, but I brought to the committee is, why don't we merge that? So those people get one coverage for their family, because in medical industry, if you have double coverage, both those insurance companies start pointing at the other and say you're primary, right? And it's really not much benefit. To offset that, I suggested that, you know, people be voluntarily allowed to waive out of that and have a carrot, you know, $400 in their paycheck increase to give up that, voluntarily give up that insurance package would probably incentivize quite a few people to do it, and it would save the state about $800. So my idea was a third. In 1067, I believe that their proposal is just to eliminate that double coverage. But it goes further than that. If you look at classified students in, you know, or classified teachers and staff in K through 12, in Oregon, we don't allow those employees to go into the exchange. And so if you have a lower federal poverty level in your job and you're working for the state of Oregon, other states allow them to buy into the exchange. Federal government will pay up to 90% of that. That's the same hospital. It's the same doctor. It's the same insurance company. But they just allow the federal government to pay for part of it. That was something that we weren't able to get into that package. And for our retired employees, voluntarily, if they wanted to supplement their Medicaid and have a larger check sent to them, that's something else we could do. So there's actually more cost savings, I think, without hurting the employees in healthcare, which we just haven't gotten across the line. And we've had some pretty smart people look at this. It's around $300 or $400 million that could be recouped. The one bucket that they did do in 1067, they're saying is around $100 million. So that could be a step in the right direction. So we just need to get a balanced approach to revenue, match that up with real cost containment, and you'll come up with a bipartisan bill. Thank you.
Now we will break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table and then return with those audience questions. Take a break.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the July 14th City Club program, the Oregon 2017 Legislative Wrap-Up. Support for City Club of Eugene is from members and sponsors. Sponsors include Jerry Detelm. Jerry Detelm is a Eugene architect, landscape architect, and planning and urban design consultant, and also the Academic Extension of the University of Oregon. Academic Extension brings the university's fine teaching and research to our regional community. And now to member questions.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. The time that you have to talk to each other about all of these bills, say 3,500 of them, most of them being not paid attention to the during the course, do you have enough time in either the long or the short session to consider these things? Do you feel it's sufficient?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, the bills are broken up by committee, and there's quite a few committees. Maybe you know an exact number in the House and the Senate, and so we get asked, I get asked by Speaker Kotek or get assigned by the Speaker of the House to serve on certain committees, and it's typically three committees. And within those three committees, it's the person that's asked to serve their obligation to review all of the bills within those committees and to be knowledgeable about those committees. And then, like example in healthcare, for our caucus, I happen to be assigned to the committees, but I'm also assigned by my caucus to be what they call the first chair on those healthcare ones. And so I present to my caucus all of the healthcare bills that come through the House. And so of the thousands of bills, you know, not 3,000 or 4,000 of them actually pass. Some of them don't get hearings. Some of them don't go anywhere, but a lot of them do get discussed. And of those discussions, the House has a lot of interaction with the House. The Senate has interaction with the House when we walk across to the other side to have discussions with them. But you'd be surprised how separately those two entities function other than personal outreach.
Let me just say, sometimes I will actually walk over to the House side to talk to people instead of waiting for them to come see me. And answer the question, Bob, and this is Floyd Przanski. I do believe the time we have for the long session, 160 days, is appropriate. I think the timing of when it starts is wrong. I am going to be bringing, and here's my heads up for the bill I'm going to be bringing during the interim, will be one that will set the conclusion date for the long session, which is 160 days, having it conclude on June 30th, and then we'll back up 160 days for when the start is. Currently, we have about a 2.5 week period from the time we organize in the long session in January before we start the session on the first day of February. That's way too long, and we should not be there after 4th of July. So by setting it up where we will conclude by the end of June, and we've done this during our multiple trials and errors in our most recent sessions, we will be able to do our work in that such. During the 35-day short session, which is during the even number of years, that session was really set up to more be for adjustments of budgets, and making sure the revenue is coming in, and we weren't really supposed to be doing a lot of policy work. You're going to see more restrictions, limitations on the amount of policy work that we'll be taking on in the short session. So currently, I would say the 35 days is appropriate for what it was intended to do.
Susan Connolly, City Club member since 2008. Thank you both so much for coming. Our table wanted to know what happened to the pot money. It's our understanding that that money was earmarked for education, and we would like to know, where's the money?
Where's the money? Where's Waldo? What happened in Measure 91, when it was passed by the voters, it called out for the division of revenue to go in multiple different directions. Education was one of the areas that it was supposed to go into, but it wasn't exclusively there. Also into local coffers for public safety, for treatment, also has a cut of that. When we started working on this endeavor in the 2015 session, the first long session after it was passed by the voters in 2014, there were some adjustments as to how the money would be broken out and the percentages and such, but they still have earmarks for those areas. The area of education, because of how it was originally written into the measure that was passed by the voters, it wasn't going directly to the classrooms, and so we've restructured that so we can get the money more there. Currently, what is happening with the revenue that's coming in is paying for all of the offsets, all of the ongoing cost of state government for taking on this new adventure, this new commodity of a product, and so just getting the staffing levels and all of the different components of the agencies, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, OLCC, OHA, and the Department of Ag. Those three agencies are all involved in some fashion with the expansion of the cannabis in the state.
Sandy Erickson, City Club member. Climate change is marching north, and it's getting, it's accelerating, and it affects everyone from major business level to person's everyday life. So I'm interested in knowing what this legislature did to prepare Oregon with all its natural resources in abundance for adaptation to climate change.
The area of looking at our natural resources, and I come from House District 7, where there's a lot of natural resources. We, in the state of Oregon, we have a lot of good natural resources, and we need to keep those clean, and we need to keep those sustainable. One of the things that we did in the legislature was to approve some biomass usage to add those to the... So, you know, coming from where we have the natural resources, I believe that we should use them. I believe that we should use them in a sustainable manner, and so that we can have the economies from that. I don't believe that we can't have a balance between the environment and utilizing our natural resources. So I actually supported the biomass, and that's why you have, you know, me here speaking, because there's two sides to the equation. You know, I am a supporter of strong environmental, clean water, and being able to do that. But at the same time, we've got to balance that with our economy. Here in Oregon, we have a good economy. I hate to see places like Roseburg Lumber finding other states to go to. And so, you know, I think we're a little unbalanced there right now.
So let me kind of channel for, this is Floyd Przanski again for those on the radio. I'll channel for Representative Hovey. Paul Hovey is one of the individuals, he and Senator Meyer for over a year met in trying to look at how we can make things different within our energy structure and with our climate. Paul came up with what was known as House Bill 2020, and this was a what he referred to as a common sense next step approach for Oregon's energy and climate future. Basically, what he wanted to do, we know and what's come out in the press just in the last month to 6 weeks, that there are some issues that have happened at the Oregon Department of Energy that have called and questioned the procedures that are being used, the leadership there, et cetera. What Paul, as well as Lee, had been working on is how do we restructure that area? How do we ensure, looking that we're going forward in time as to addressing these issues, as the questioner asked, regarding climate change? This bill would have, in fact, structured a framework within the Oregon Department of Energy that would, in fact, take us to the next level of applying and applying for and ensuring that we are able to adapt to climate change. The reason the bill did not go forward? Because it had one word in it, climate. And because it had the word climate in it, we were not able to get enough individuals on both sides of the aisle to actually move forward on the bill because it had the word climate. And the reality, what we're trying to deal with, is change in our climate. Why wouldn't you want to have that as part of your mission, as part of the phrase? So this is another one of those situations where when sausage is being made, the recipe's not always followed.
Paula Grisafi, City Club member. This is, I think, from Senator Przanski mostly, but I spent some time up in Salem this year and noticed just how much power Senate leadership had to direct what bills were being dealt with. And I wanted to know how the leadership gets chosen, when it gets chosen, and what we as citizens can do to influence that choice.
Oh, let's see. Is this broadcast up in Salem? Again, that's Floyd Przanski. The way it works is it is a democratic process, and that's with a small d. I think both all four caucuses, the two Republican as well as the two Democratic caucuses, uses basically the same framework. First of all, for the Senate I'll speak of, it's after the elections in the November elections of the even number years, when you actually know what the numbers are going to be to make up the total body of the legislature. And whoever has the majority, meaning Democrat versus Republican, they're going to be making certain decisions that would be toward leadership. The party that is not having does not have the majority will also be making those same decisions, but they will be first making it for their own caucuses. And that's where everything is kind of set up. And it's basically a numbers game. In the Senate now, the Senate has 17 Democrats and 13 Republicans. So for us to make any changes in our leadership, you need to have 9 Democrats out of the 17 that would be supporting an individual to put them in a leadership position within our caucus, or the person that we were looking at putting forward potentially as the president of the Senate. Same thing on the House side. I'll let Cedric kind of explain that process in part. But it's basically done through that process. I will tell you that I've heard a number of individuals being very concerned as to what we weren't able to accomplish with the majority, and that there are a number of individuals that throughout the state that are looking for making changes. So what can you do? One, be active in your own ways of voting and being part of the process. Also reaching out to those who live in other parts of the state, especially those who you may have issues with that are serving and representing those other issues. Maybe you want to talk to your friends, your family, and your neighbors, and make sure they know what you know or what you feel and see how they feel. And that's how I think you're going to see change at the grassroots level, is actually bringing forward. I've also heard, and this is just within a week, if you remember, we just finished at noon 7 days ago. I believe the House finished about three and a half hours after us. So this is very fresh, very raw for a lot of people. But I do know that there are a lot of advocacy groups that are looking at trying to make changes in leadership by getting new people in those positions.
So thank you for the question. Cedric Hayden, State Representative, House District 7. On the House side, of course, we have the two parties, the Republican and Democrat Party, and the Republicans typically do exactly what was explained here. After the November election, we get together and decide leadership and there's 25 of us in there, and so if you have 13 votes, it's kind of like high school president. I mean, it really is. You, if you have the votes, you get to be that position. And then we've got really about three positions. You've got the, on our side, the minority leader, and then you've got the assistant leader to that, and then you have the whip, which is the person that counts the votes, and then there's other positions that are picked by those three people. I believe the Democrats actually do it right after the long session. I think they just did their leadership now, so they're offset with us a little bit. How you get involved is be willing to do things like what you're doing here, and be willing. We often get inundated with ideas from people of our political persuasion, if you will. Be willing to talk to the ones across the aisle that you may or may not agree with, because I think you have a better fertile soil there to actually cultivate a relationship and explain that point of view. You know, if I get a whole bunch of emails on something I support, I send back and say, I support that. But if I get emails on something that I have a concern with, then I send back an email or a phone call or a letter explaining why I have concern with that. So I think cultivating those relationships on both sides is important.
We have time for one more question.
David Edrington, I'm an architect and a recent member of the City Club. The Residential Energy Conservation Program is a 40-year-old existing program that's been used very successfully by over 500,000 instances. You all let it expire. Why? Is energy conservation not important anymore?
This is where I wish I had the phone number for my lifeline, because I'm not really sure I'm going to be able to answer the question. I'm assuming this is a tax credit. And so if this is a tax credit, what I can tell you is what has happened. Probably about 6 years ago, we've been working on it for many years before that, trying to ensure that tax credits that are on the book actually fit the need of what they were intended to do and make either adjustments or abolish them. In the last three sessions, I'm going to say thereabouts, we've actually had a committee that's made up of tax credit reviews. On our side, I mean the Senate side, Mark Hass, who's the chair of revenue on the House side, I'm assuming it's Phil Barnhart, who's the chair of the revenue on that side, they co-chair this committee, and then they basically, every 3 years, every tax credit comes up for review and analysis. I'm assuming without being, without having any notes, since I didn't serve on that committee, that they went through that process and decided and determined for whatever reason that it should not continue. That's your understanding, that it has outright expired. Sometimes it may appear that something expired, but there may be something else that was replacing it in a different set, and that I don't know. So I apologize, I don't have a better answer, but if you want to give me your name afterwards, I'll make sure that we get a more concise answer for you.
Thank you again, Senator Caden, State Representative, House District 7. In 2015, I was on Human Services and Housing, and we did a lot of those tax credits. They basically took all of the tax credits and split those up into three different buckets, if you will, and then tackled a third of the tax credits, third of the tax credits, and third of the tax credits. And then those go through a process of hearings. I didn't get the privilege of getting back on that committee for this round. I got put on early childhood and family development instead, which I enjoy a lot because I'm passionate about that. So the sausage making of that process, I think it was around a $40 million tax credit, if I remember right. It wasn't in those hearings as why they decided certain tax credits to move and certain tax credits not to move. I can tell you back in 2015, there was a little tax credit for people that had lost two or more limbs, and it got eliminated. It was a very small tax credit. But for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why we would eliminate this for people that are so severely disadvantaged. And sometimes things just go through that you shake your head and you say, how did that happen? So I don't have a better answer for you other than just, again, being involved. Reach out when you see that coming. It's almost like in Salem, if there doesn't get enough noise volume on an issue, it just kind of slides by.
Before we thank our guests today, there are a few quick announcements. Again, we appreciate our sponsors, including the Oregon Country Fair, Jerry Detelm Architect, and the Academic Extension of the University of Oregon. We also thank KLCC for airing our programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m. and to Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs. In next week's program, Travelers in Eugene, Problem or Only Another Lifestyle, we will explore the topic of who is traveling through and how they may be a different population from the more typically described homeless, and how those differences influence local assistance programs. More information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And now let's give a big thank you and round of applause to today's speakers, State Senator Floyd Prezanski, State Representative Cedric Hayden, and State Representative Julie Fahey. Thank you all, and this concludes today's program.